tonight on Arena. Stuart Carolan on life before and after Love Hate, and Rachel Kushner talks motorbikes, prisons and memory in her new essay collection, The Hard Crowd. is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. What do Derry Girls, Love Hate, The Snapper and more recently Smother all have in common? Well, they were created by talented Irish screenwriters, and those writers, Lisa McGee, Stuart Carolan, Roddy Doyle and Kate O'Riordan, will be discussing their craft and their careers as part of the inaugural Dublin International Screenwriting Festival this week. The festival was established to celebrate the craft of screenwriting in Ireland and to develop opportunities for screenwriting both at home and abroad. And delighted to be joined this evening on the programme by Stuart Carolan. Stuart, we often hear how this country, we punch above our weight when it comes to literature, to music, to theatre and to other art forms as well. How do we fare when it comes to screenwriting?
I don't know. I haven't given that a huge amount of thought, to be honest with you. You know, it's just kind of like head down and try and get stuff made. So
You may be telling us the secret of good screening writing then, which is head down and get the stuff made. Now, the reason I ask you that, obviously so many people know you from Love Hate and the huge success that it was here at home. But, you know, in more recent times, you've been involved on an American TV series, The Alienist, Angel of Darkness, where you were the showrunner. And we'll come back and discuss The Alienist in more detail. But the difference between those two things, you know, did you find yourself saying, oh, I'm in a whole different ball game here? Or did you think, nah, this may have more money behind it, but, you know, it's the same basic, it's the same qualities that are looked for and needed.
Yeah, a bit of both. I mean, I think it's the same thing in one way. You know, I think if I think about it in a certain way, the budget is totally different. You know, Love Hate, you're on making for, I don't know, $600,000 an episode, which kind of sounds a lot, but it's not. Whereas The Alienist was closer to, you know, I don't know, $8-9 million an episode. So it was, fundamentally the same thing. I think with Love, it was more like it was kind of guerrilla style, you know? So you kind of learned a lot doing it that way. I think there's a few things that are kind of pretty different from the American system. And the American system is, I mean, it is different in a certain way, because it's so huge and it's, you know, it's like driving an articulated truck. You know, it's like you've got the writer's room straight off, and that's something else. We had a writer's room in New York, and then we were filming mainly in Budapest for about 6 months. But the kind of work there is, it's sort of like you're a kind of project manager almost, you know, and you work closely with like the directors. In this case, it was David Caffrey, worked with on Love Hate. And then you're the HODs, the heads of department, you know, production designer and all that kind of stuff. And a lot of that is simply, it's kind of like advanced planning. So they want to know, you know, like what kind of sets to build, you know, and it's very, very practical. So that's something that's quite similar to Love Hate in the sense you just need to, you know, there's only so many, you know, there's only so many scenes you can have. There's only, if you film on a location, you have to use it a number of times to make it economical. There's all these kind of factors. And I think then, so that was kind of similar but different. And then the last thing, which I think is very different, is in a way I think it's a very political over there, because you're dealing with the studio and the network, and in this case it was Paramount and then Warner Media, and they're kind of big beasts and everybody's got an opinion, and so there's a lot of notes. So you know you're There's sort of continual assessment on the scripts. There's continual conversations on that when you're in the writer's room before production. And then in the middle of production, you're talking about stuff that you're filming, stuff that you're about to, that you've just written, and stuff that's hasn't been written yet. So there's an awful lot of that.
A lot going on all at the same time, which is a very different experience, I would guess, from the almost lone wolf and, as you say, a kind of guerrilla aspect that was there in Love Hate, because all of the episodes were written by you. It was your initial idea. You know, when you started with Love Hate, you know, back in God's old time, I mean, and it was it took off so well and ran, you know, it became such a focal point in terms of television watching in this country for a period of time. Had you any idea, with the little germ of an idea that you had, that it would grow into what it became?
No, not at all. I mean, one of the things, and you know, people often ask about that type of thing and how does it work. One of the things that's interesting when, you know, in the TV business is that most of the stuff you're doing fails. So kind of, you don't like, so, you know, you write screenplays that never get made. You know, you can write whole seasons of things that never get made. So there's a huge amount of failure. So by the time you get to, when I got to Love Hate, I had a lot of failures under my belt. So you don't really think, you think in terms of, you know, you really think in terms of, oh, great, I've got a commission straight off. Oh, great. You know, I'll write a pilot. Oh, it's getting made. And that's how far you think. Mm. You know, in my own mind, I knew that it was, you know, I could see, you know, 10, 15, 20 episodes ahead in a certain way. But I think that the big thing for me at the time was just that it's like two things. One is like having somebody support you at a kind of, I suppose, an executive level. And that was Jane Gogan at the time in RTE. And then the other thing, and I think that I'd, like this is in a way what the most important thing is, that sense of camaraderie that you were with somebody. So with David Caffrey, it was huge. You know, somebody you can you know, chew the fat with, talk about things. And I found in everything I've done that's been just key, that you have, you know, being part of a team.
Well, let's just remind ourselves of some of the brilliance of the series. Inevitably, it'll have to feature Nidge, wouldn't it? Tom Von Laar, what a performance that was. And this is from early on in the series, and obviously, because we have Darren is still here, the Robert Sheehan character, and Nidge is making it clear that he doesn't care about anyone at all. Very strong language in the midst of this clip.
Yeah.
I'll be straight up with you. I don't give a shit about anyone, man. I don't give a shit. Except for Warren. The rest, I don't care. Not even Trish. I love her and all, you know, but I don't give a shit. And I'll do whatever the fuck it is I have to do. I'll do it. I don't care. I'll get on with it. There's no way out for you in this, Darren. Straight up, there's no way out. I wouldn't bullshit you. You have to do it, and that's it. You don't do it. Whenever happens, happens, and you're thinking, I'm in all this shit because of what? Because of Stumpy. I'm telling you, Darren, you're fucked if you don't do this. Fuck knows what'll happen, but I swear to God it'll happen. And you'll have pissed it all away. Understand? Yeah. Good.
Robert Sheehan and Tom Von Laar are in a scene there from Love Hate. Stuart Carlin with me. It's still amazing to hear that. It's as fresh as we saw it in whatever season
I think I might have been talking about writing deadlines when I listened to Nate talk about
One question just before I move off Love Hate, Stuart. At what point did you realise, and close your ears if you haven't seen the series of this, did you realise, I'm going to kill characters, big characters off as this goes along?
Again, some of it is very practical. I think that, you know, like I was lucky to get Aidan Gillen in the first season, and I didn't think, you know, for the second season we'd have him for that long. I think, you know, in shows outside of Ireland, people can be signed into, you know, 7-year deals. Mm. And with this, it was, you know, we never knew if we were going to go ahead or not, you know, from year to year. You kind of have a rough sense of it, but you can't 100% guarantee it. So it's kind of almost slightly like handshake deals with the actors, you know. So I kind of always thought with Aidan that to have him for two seasons was lucky. So I didn't think we'd get away with a third. And similarly with Robert Sheehan. So there was some of those. That was an aspect of it. And then in case of other characters, there's characters you really wanted to keep, and you just felt that in terms of the storyline, it just made sense. You know, if it's a tragic arc for a character. So it's a bit about practical stuff, and then, you know, just what you think that is naturally going to happen with a character.
So the lesson for the actor is don't have too big a career or you'll die in seasons three or four in the Stuart Carlin series. Just tell me briefly a little bit about The Alienist. Are we in season two, or are we finished season two at this point? Where are you at with it, Stuart?
Yeah, it's season two. It's a kind of standalone because it's based on Caleb Carr's books. So the first one was The Alienist, and the one I worked on was Angel of Darkness. So it was, we've just done that. So that's gone out, you know.
And you were the showrunner on that. That's a very different experience than what you had on Love Hate, where, yeah, you were writing, but you weren't doing everything.
Yeah, I mean, the Love Hate was pretty interactive in some ways. You know, there was like that the kind of team aspect. So you're talking to a lot of people and you're involved in all those things. But no, it's a totally different experience, really. You know, and it's also like pretty shattering. You know, because it's you're like 6 a.m. till midnight. Yeah. So I needed a bit of a break afterwards. It was very intense, and I think. I felt there was a lot riding on it just because everything was so big in terms of the budgets. You know, we had a back lot in Budapest and it cost 30 million to build. So there's that, you know, there's that feeling of that pressure. And it's not the worst in the sense it's not live, so it's okay. It's just, it's a kind of, you know, after, you know, things close to a year, you start to feel the grind. Mm. So you just feel, you start getting tired. But then everybody does. Anybody talks about the working on TV shows after a while, you start feeling tired after a while, you know, and you love just moaning about it and comparing your various ailments. And says everybody starts getting sick.
And then eventually you have to do what you said to me at the top of the interview, which is put the head down and do the work. Listen, great to speak with you this evening, Stuart. Continued success and best of luck with all you have coming up ahead of you, and indeed with the festival as well. Thanks for being with us, Stuart.
Thanks, Sean.
Stuart Carlin, and the Dublin International Screenwriting Festival takes place online from Monday, April the 23rd, and you can find out more information on disf.ie. A new documentary is on its way to us tonight on RTE1 television at 9:35. In Cullum Tobin on Memory Shore, we see the novelist in his native Wexford, in Dublin and in Venice, where some of his new novel, The Magician, is set. It's about the writer Thomas Mann. Throughout this landmark documentary, Cullum talks about what it means to be a writer, what inspires him as a writer, and what it takes for a writer to be good at his or her craft. Here he is in Venice, looking at the famous Tintoretto painting, The Crucifixion.
I think if you're writing a novel, you're trying to put shape on experience. You've got to keep the author out of the picture, let an element of the untidiness, shapelessness of life to enter in. I mean, you can list the writers who have come and describe this painting, because I think for anyone involved in narrative, this is a great narrative painting. If only they'd known that day what this was. And clearly, that man over there doesn't. And he's going to be busy the rest of the day, and someone will later say to him, but you were at the crucifixion. He said, no, it's just a thing that day. It was nothing. It goes right through fiction, that lovely idea of who knows and who doesn't. And I think this painting is a great dramatization of knowing and not knowing. Clearly, the figures down here know. But they're also fully human in their grief, in the way they're wrapped around each other. And then all around are just figures at a spectacle.
And staying on that theme of humanity in fiction, later in this evening's documentary, Cullum Tobin talks about Ernest Hemingway's approach to evoking a sense of authenticity of feeling and what that means to him as a writer of fiction.
I love the idea of Hemingway being in Paris. And there's some paintings by Cézanne on display. Hemingway starts to look at Cézanne. And he starts to look at the way each brush stroke is on display. And each brush stroke is small, and each brush stroke is slightly different. So there might be a repetition of a brown, but he's added a yellow, he's added a green. And you can see each brush stroke in a Cézanne. Hemingway became fascinated, and he writes about this. I mean, it's not something I've invented. Hemingway writes letters about it and has an essay about it in his Paris book, the importance of Cézanne's work for Hemingway. And the idea is that in order to evoke something, as a writer, you have to feel it. Nothing will happen unless you feel it. You have to see it and feel it and be within it. Now, working from that, you then can write very short sentences, which seem to be doing nothing much, but actually because they come from your feeling, they're building up a sort of emotion that equals the emotion that you felt before you wrote them. And so they're not dead on the page. However, if you misuse it, they become so dead on the page. I mean, in some of Hemingway, there's a self-parody as he uses a trick. He plays it as a trick. It's not a trick. It has to be fresh. It has to be as no one's ever done it before. And so you can go, she went to the window. For a while she stood there. She didn't even look. We need to look. Nothing came into her mind at that moment. And you keep working. And for some, out of that, you should be able to get something. But if the feeling is flawed, the sentences are flawed. So you have to know. So you have to have the feeling. It has to be raw and in need of exchange. In other words, you have to want something you want to communicate.
That's certainly whetted my appetite. Colm Tobin there in Brendan J. Byrne's documentary, Colm Tobin on Memory Shore, which will be broadcast tonight on RTÉ1 Television at 9:35. Rachel Kushner was last on Arena at the time of the publication of her Man Booker shortlisted novel, The Mars Room, which was set in Stanville Women's Correctional Facility in California. She has now published a collection of thrilling essays called The Hard Crowd, covering a wide range of topics. In one, it's the Cabo 1000, a notorious motorbike race on dirt roads. In another, it's an account of her time in Shuafat refugee camp in East Jerusalem. And towards the end of the collection, she looks once again at the American prison system, this time asking the ultimate question: is prison necessary? I'm delighted to be joined by Rachel Kushner to talk about the collection this evening on Arena. Thanks for being with us, Rachel. Let's go straight away to Girl on a Motorcycle, which is how the collection actually opens, and that Cabo 1000 motorcycle race. First of all, your own love of, there's lots of motorised vehicles in the collection, but your own love of motorbicycles, I think, goes right back to your dad.
It does. It starts with him. The essay opens describing my father's motorcycle that he bought in London when my parents lived there before I was born. He bought a Vincent Black Shadow and ended up bringing it back to the United States. And it was a part of my childhood, him working on the Vincent. And also a part of my childhood was the kind of lore of the Vincent being kind of the Kawasaki Ninja of its time, one of the fastest motorcycles ever built. It had a 1,000cc motor. You know, it was an impressive bike, beautiful, somewhat rare and rarefied at that point. So I think that it influenced my love of bikes. But I should say that I don't ride motorcycles anymore. But, you know, I did for a long time ride them. And that essay kind of, I guess, gives an account of what I was up to before I was a writer.
Yeah, before you got off the bicycle and sat at the desk. But I love the way you even said Vincent Black Shadow. I could almost hear a whole world conjured up in your mind. And you do throughout that essay and later, as I say, about other motorised vehicles. When you give us the names of these different cars, different motor bicycles, it strikes me that even those names hold almost a mythology for you.
I think that's true. I mean, I was just thinking, you know, my parents didn't have religion, but they did have the Vincent Black Shadow.
And they believed totally in the Vincent Black Shadow, unquestionably, from what you're saying. Perhaps the reason that you no longer ride motor bicycles has to do with fairly hairy experiences that you had during that motor bicycle race, the Cabo 1000.
Maybe. I mean, I did crash in that race, which I describe in great detail in the book, and a lot of sort of interesting but unfortunate things happened subsequent to the race, such as having my crashed motorcycle stolen from me, you know, losing all my possessions in the desert. But I continued to ride motorcycles after that, and in fact, fixed up that Ninja, rode it, eventually sold it. Got another Italian motorcycle, which I had Italian bikes previous to the Ninja. But I think eventually I began to realize that you really have to love bikes enough to be willing to trade your life for them. Because I saw a lot of friends die, and not just taking risks, but simply going to the post office and making a left turn when a car doesn't see them signaling. So I guess I just started to feel like it just wasn't worth that risk to me. I still miss them, but I've moved on to other pastures.
I wonder, was part of the way of dealing with missing them, and I'm not sure when you wrote The Flamethrowers, which was your second novel, whether you had stopped riding the bicycles at the motorbicycles at that stage, because motor bicycles and Italian motor bicycles specifically are a very important part of that non-fiction work, or that fiction work, I beg your pardon.
It's true. So I had given them up. I had just had a baby actually before I wrote The Flamethrowers, which isn't really connected to giving up motorcycles, but maybe just reconfirms that it was a different phase of my life. But in thinking about a character like the protagonist in The Flamethrowers, who goes to New York City, comes from the West, wants to be an artist at a time when people are getting out of the studio, even traveling west, like the land artist, Robert Smithson, who made the Spiral Jetty. And she's thinking about her own contribution. And I realized she could be a motorcycle rider like I was. And it's a place when you're writing fiction where you can sort of start to pull from bodies of knowledge that you've acquired through the course of your life. And I knew that I could write about motorcycles believably, since I spent quite a few years kind of living and breathing in that world. And so it just, you know, it fit the character and the milieu that she's in for The Flamethrowers.
Yeah, and it is interesting that in some ways the motorcycling fits into the fictional work in that respect and into the non-fictional work. And as I say, other motorized vehicles get mentioned along the way here as well. Is it a very different process? You started as a mostly writing in the area of art criticism. Is it a very different process writing in this non-fictional world than it is writing in your fictional world?
I should say that I started publishing pieces of art criticism and other pieces before I'd published any fiction, but the entire time I was sort of trying to teach myself how to write, you know, my first novel, which took me, I don't know, 6 or 7 years to figure out and to write and to publish. It is different for me in the sense that it's far more straightforward. I know I can write an essay. The tack that I take sometimes will surprise me, but it's not as mysterious of a process as fiction tends to be. It takes me 5 years to write a novel. Of course, these essays are, you know, accrued over 20 years, but each one of them I can write much more quickly than that.
Yeah, it's different in that respect. What about what brought you to the Shoafat refugee camp in East Jerusalem in 2016? Were you going there specifically with writing in mind, or was there another reason that actually was the initial motivation?
Well, I was invited by two writers, Michael Chabon and his wife, another writer, Ayelet Waldman, and they were putting together an anthology of the 50th anniversary of the occupation of the West Bank by Israel. And I had never been somebody who considered myself, I don't know, involved in that geopolitical conundrum, that territory. You know, it was pretty abstract to me. And I thought I was being invited to go and spend 10 days traveling around Israel and Palestine, meeting lots of people and just getting lots and lots of information. And it seemed like an offer I couldn't turn down because I would learn so much. And at the end of that 10 days trip, they wanted each writer who was invited to choose a subject of their own, and they would support you in whatever way they needed. They had lots and lots of contacts. And I chose to go to Shoafat refugee camp after reading about it. It's the only refugee camp inside, technically, the border of Israel. And it's where 85,000 people live in one square kilometer. And it just so happened that people they knew somebody who was sort of a de facto organizer and community leader in the camp. And so I was invited to be a guest and stay with his family and spend the weekend with him, learning about the camp and the plans he had for the future of the camp as a tireless advocate for Palestinian people who were living there.
And that man was Baha Nababta, and seems to be quite a charismatic character and quite beloved of all of those who were in the camp. But some of the things that you discovered there, I think you were as surprised as I'm guessing the reader will be, and certainly I was, to hear about some of them, not least of which was a shopping mall.
Yes, there is a shopping mall in Shuafat. I guess the Israeli military had... they had bulldozed it twice, and the residents of the camp just kept rebuilding it. And when I was there, it had two floors and they were building a third. Shuafat's complicated, but it is a world where people live and try to thrive, but they do it, you know, without any services, without legal water or electricity or land registration or police or any other kind of emergency systems, you know, no fire department, very few schools, no paved roads, really, except for those that people like Baha had organized work crews to voluntarily, construct themselves.
And the irony of all of that is, I was mentioning the shopping mall, and it gives this impression that, oh, well, things mustn't be too bad if there's a shopping mall there, but there's no infrastructure at all, despite the fact that the residents pay taxes to Israel.
That's true. And actually, I mean, I don't really tend to think that journalism is a form of activism or that it can make great change. But after I wrote that piece, there were editorials in Israel that did actually end up resulting in some municipal changes to Israel's relationship to the camp. And I think that they did start to take some responsibility and try to build some infrastructure there, considering that those residents, as you point out, do pay taxes.
How safe did you feel there, or how unsafe did you feel when you were there?
It never crossed my mind that I wasn't safe there. I think that there is a way in which, for better or worse, and mostly worse, an American traveling abroad feels somewhat invincible because she's treated as a special guest. It was so unusual for people there to meet an American that I felt kind of protected in this bubble of my guest status that was being conferred on me. I will say that traveling around Palestine and meeting people and witnessing what people endure at places like the checkpoints where men line up at 3 a.m. to get into Israel to go to work, and neighborhoods where Palestinians have cages around their homes so that Israelis can't throw things at them, and vice versa, there was one thing that sort of prepared me for that. And that was visiting West Belfast.
It prepared you for the visit. So in what way did it prepare you? Explain that a bit further.
Well, maybe it's strange to say, but seeing a entrenched strife up close that sometimes is rooted in poverty, I think that maybe it didn't exactly prepare me, but certain things that I saw in Palestine were not dissimilar from certain things that I saw in Ireland.
And poverty was at the very heart of that, which is very interesting, given that I was struck the last time we spoke, in fact, when you were talking to me about the Mars Room, you used a phrase which really stuck in my mind at the time. And I listened back today just to remind myself of it, which was, I'm lucky enough to have middle class resources. And you were speaking about the fictional characters in the Mars Room who don't have those resources behind them. When you come to your essay, Is Prison Necessary? You really are looking at the system itself, but really, what is it that puts people in situations that they find themselves in prison?
Yeah, I mean, that essay, I was interested in the scholarship of the carceral geographer, Ruth Wilson Gilmore, who'd written a book about California called Golden Gulag. And in that book, she really tries to account for how it is that California built something like 23 prisons in 21 years, embarking upon what state bureaucrats themselves called the largest prison building project ever undertaken in the history of the world. And there are a lot of different reasons for it. And I'm always sort of suspicious of reasons that reduce too easily to conspiracy or cruelty. Sometimes those are factors, but there are other factors as well. The economy, a boom and bust cycle, cycles of drought. You know, we grow almost half of the country's food here in California, and the prisons are all sited in industrial agriculture, land that became fallow, and then the growers wanted to sell it, and the state offered to buy it. And once you have a big prison system, states are very good at filling those prisons. So Gilmore gives this very full, complex account of how we came to be an incarceration state here in California. And I wanted to sit down with her and ask her a lot of questions and really dig into her work. And doing so in nonfiction is a great platform for me because it's just so separate from the world of fiction. It's overtly political, which I don't think fiction is a place for.
That's a big argument, but let us move on to just a final essay that I'd like to touch on, because we've spoken particularly in the prisons. The prison, is prison necessary? And We Are Orphans Here is the title of the essay about the refugee camp. But there are so many of these essays that are very personal and about very personal memories. And I'd like to finish with the one that gives the collection its title, The Hard Crowd. You were the soft girl, you say, in the hard crowd that you grew up with.
Well, I make that claim, but I don't know if it's really true. It's a way of thinking into a certain distance that one recalls from adolescence. But in a sense, I think everyone feels that distance, even people who are, you know, the hard crowd. As I say, a writer, maybe you know the line better than I do, to become a writer is to have left early no matter what time you get home. So, you know, I stayed out late, but there was, for me, some distance there.
Just explain that a little bit further to us, that, you know, when you're looking back at things, is it that you see them totally different, or that you need that distance to analyze them in any way?
Well, it's more that... I think that anybody who has the presence of mind to absorb the details of a scene, of a moment, of their own life and other people's, and to kind of be stained by those details and to continually tarry with them and think about them years later. You know, at this point in my life, I've known so many people. And when I was younger, I knew a lot of people that didn't make it, that are really no longer around. And if I'm the one who is the scribe who's recording those worlds, describing those people and my own feelings in certain situations, that in itself suggests great distance.
You say at the end of that essay, or towards the end of that essay, that you're talking about your own life in this essay, and you do in other essays as well talk about your own life. But you say it to us, the readers, get your own gig, make your litany as I have just made mine, keep your tally, mind your dead and your living, and you can bore me. You claim you bore us, but you don't, or you claim you might, you're worried you might bore us, you don't bore us. Are you encouraging people to do that? You know, sit down and write from memory and see what comes up.
In a way, yes. I mean, I'm inviting the reader to join me in a project of reflection that I think starts to happen to a lot of people as a natural process over the course of life once you've reached a certain point. I was being a little glib in saying, you know, the details of my life might bore you. If I really thought that, I probably wouldn't have published the essay, and instead was sort of saying, I realize that I'm cataloging a lot of events and people that, you know, you weren't there for and didn't know, but you also have yours. So do what I've done, and then you can do the same. But in a way, that essay, it was excerpted in The New Yorker, and a lot of people read it and reached out to me with their own stories. Mostly people who, I mean, many people who inhabited the same world I did of an old San Francisco in the 80s and 90s, a place that really has vanished, but other people as well from other places. And that was really fun. I did not feel, as I for a moment worried I might, that I was going to be deluged with people's boring stories. In fact, they seemed to kind of take up the torch, and it became a back and forth. And I'm happy about that.
Rachel Kushner has been speaking to me about her latest collection of essays. It's called The Hard Crowd, and it's published by Penguin.
16 minutes to 8 on Monday night's Arena. Music Town, the annual celebration of the musical diversity of Dublin City, kicked off last Thursday and continues through until this Sunday, April 25th. Amongst the performers at this year's festival, a good friend of this programme, Junior Brother, also known as Ronan Keeley. Hibernorama is a collaboration between Junior Brother and filmmaker Bob Gallagher. As we will find out, the setting is certainly very intriguing, and I'll ask Ronan and Bob a little bit more about that when we speak to them in a few minutes' time. But before we talk to them, let's hear one of the songs that features in Hibernorama. This is The Lambs on the Green Hills.
I ran and before, not knowing where to go. Since I'm my will, I see I'll be by your side. Although you are wed to another. Stop, said the groomsman, till I speak a word.
There we go, a little section there from The Lambs on the Green Hills, one of the songs performed by Junior Brother and taken from a video project entitled Hibernorama, which will be streamed this Thursday, April the 22nd, as part of the Music Town Festival 2021. Junior Brother, also known as Ronan Keeley, joins me this evening, as does the filmmaker with whom Junior or Ronan is collaborating on this project, Bob Gallagher. First, that song, first of all, Junior, you probably kill me for choosing to play that one, because it's the only one in the set and in the project that isn't your own song. But when I heard it first, I thought, that's a real Junior Brother song. So tell us its origins and how you turned it into your song, or what made me think it was your song.
Hi, Sean, how's it going? So that's a traditional song, and I just found it in a big book I was given years ago. Called 100 Ballads and Traditional Songs. And I picked it up just because I read the lyrics of it, and they resonated with me. So I thought I'd make a song that's usually sung very slowly and usually unaccompanied and put it through the Junior Brother machine. And that's what resulted.
And come here to me, what resonated with you about a fella who is in love with somebody he shouldn't be in love with?
Just those kind of feelings carried over in an old song struck me as very powerful, and as folk songs tend to be, very kind of direct as well, and just very kind of unusually dark. You wouldn't find many modern songs that get dark as that song.
Yeah, it does.
The main thing I wanted to do was make it my own, basically. You know?
Yeah, and we should explain, that is just you, because as I was listening to it there, I realised, you know, when you're not looking at it, as I was earlier this afternoon, you'd say, well, there's a few people involved in playing that. So it's your guitar and the tambourine down at your foot.
That's it, yeah, and me wailing away on that.
But the guitar seems to, it sounded to me like two guitars. I don't know whether that's what the Junior Brother machine does to songs. You're kind of fading slightly there. So I'll talk to Bob for a minute and come back to you in a second, Ronan. Maybe, Bob, you could explain, I was saying that I was watching this afternoon. Explain the setup. Maybe if you even explain how the piece starts, that tells us something about the world that we're in.
Oh my God, giving the game away.
Well, maybe you don't. Just tell me this, tell me what you want to. Well, it's the opening few minutes of the song, of the piece.
No, it's fine. Like, if you could imagine sort of walking into a sleazy sort of Times Square, what would you say? Peep show. Mm-hmm. I'm putting a coin in the slot. That's sort of how the show starts. And then we see some dancing from a wonderful dancer called Nick Nicolau. And then if you were to put another coin in the slot, you might find Junior Brother in there.
Now, you have given nothing away there, but you've explained you've explained what's involved, which is this idea, which is this idea of the peep show. And in some ways, I think what you were looking for in doing that, Bob, was you didn't want to pretend that this was anything other than what it is, which is a filmed version of Junior Brother performing songs.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I don't know, we kind of had enough of people performing on empty stages with no audience that, like, the most interesting thing to do is just sort of acknowledge the reality of the situation and how sort of strange it is that, you know, people are watching gigs, but they're watching them at home on their laptop, you know, kind of on their own. And there is something voyeuristic about that inherently versus the experience of watching somebody on stage at a gig. So we sort of leaned into that sort of 200%.
Yeah.
And that's sort of what the show ended up being.
Yeah. And just explain maybe the visuals of this little peep show booth. That's it is like a booth. It's as if we're looking into a booth, really, isn't it?
Yeah. So we're divided from Junior Brother by a sheet of perspex, as much for our safety as his. And basically, he's in a sort of small box that measures about, I think it's 6 foot by 8 foot or something, surrounded by mirrors. So basically, Ronan can't see us, or he can't see the cameras, but there are cameras all around him watching him, which is probably, well, Ron will be able to talk about this more, but I'm sure it makes for a strange experience performing.
Yeah, well, we got Ronan back now on a different line, and you can explain as you're talking about that, Bob just telling us, Ronan, there about how you are in the booth essentially with mirrors all around you. You can't see anybody else, but everybody can see you in some ways. Explain the title of the piece, Hibernorama, because that will tell us something about the nature of it.
Well, the nature of it, yeah. As Bob said, I'll try not to give too much of the game away, but basically, yeah, we kind of, Bob showed me about this thing called the Hibernicon, which is like a kind of a thing in the 1800s that was used for like Irish expats who were homesick and like giving them a kind of a sense of Irishness. So we kind of took that idea and put Rama at the end of it. We were in kind of looking at a diorama, so these kind of things of being watched and getting a sense of Irishness, which is kind of what my music kind of tends to convey anyway, whether I like it or not. It's kind of a different form of Irishness. So it's kind of that kind of theme of kind of almost voyeurism mixed with kind of what being Irish means, like when you're listening to the music. So we kind of put them together and came up with that word.
And we have 56 minutes in total. There are a few interruptions to the piece. So we're going to listen to a song called "This Is My Body," and you're introducing it here in this version of it, Ronan, and then. Remember, you can't see anything. Suddenly we hear a bang, which is coming from outside the booth. We can see what it is. And let's see how that pans out, how that plays out.
Hi. Hello. Welcome to Junior Brothers Hibernorama. I'm very delighted you could all tune in this evening and watch this very special set. This next song is a special one. It's a new song. It's called "This Is My Body." And it's about, well, I suppose it's about a number of...
I find that hard to believe when I look down and I can't see my feet. This is my body now. I think I must accept. Feed a man for 7 years and this is what you'll get. And now I'm stood here in front of my own reflection, stripped from head to toe. How can she love a human potato?
And there we go, a little section from This Is My Body from Junior Brother and his collaboration with filmmaker Bob Gallagher called Hibernorama. So maybe explain what we're seeing as that happens, Ronan.
Well, what we're seeing is me introduce the song, and it's the first time I speak in the entire thing.
And we're about 20 minutes in possibly at this stage, yeah?
Yeah, that's right. And there's just me in a booth, in a small kind of box room, and with only a kind of plexiglass with another booth in front of me. And as I start to explain the meaning behind the song, a customer bangs on the window to tell me to shut up, and he starts to play, and then I play along with him. and yeah. Then the song begins.
Yeah, because my memory of watching it was that it becomes like almost like an answer and a response and call type of feel to it between two guitarists in some ways, Bob.
Yeah, I suppose we kind of wanted to get across some feeling of like the experience of the first person and how you sort of convey that online. And we just thought it'd be gas to have the viewer become the mandolin player in the shot. It's a trick where I basically strap a camera on a hurling helmet, which I've used before for a video for Villagers.
Ah, right. And the song that we heard there, the rest of the songs, apart from the first one that I played, The Lambs on the Green Hills, Ronan, they're all your own songs. And This Is My Body is a relatively new song, isn't it?
Well, the song itself, I suppose, dates back a few years, but it hasn't been released yet. So I suppose it's one of those strange cases where it's new to the audience, but it's old to me. It'll be on an upcoming project anyway, as will most of the songs on it.
An upcoming project meaning something further apart outside of Hibernorama or a new album or something like that?
Something like that, yeah. I can't announce anything at the moment, no, but this is a slight teaser, you could say, for exciting things coming up in the future.
Total teaser, Ronan Keely.
Yeah, that's me.
One final thing, Bob. You're involved in a second project as well, Atchoch, from Cucullin to the Quairfella. What's involved there?
So that is myself and a bunch of musicians and some poets in the Hugh Lane Gallery doing a show which is sort of about queer representation in traditional music and poetry.
Several very interesting. The Ballad of Reading Jail will be there, other trad songs as well. You're part of that as well, Ronan?
Yeah, I do a song and accompany a few other songs as well. Very happy to be a part of it, yeah.
So when this project ends now, what way are gigs with you, Junior? Is there anything happening or is it just, no, you take these opportunities when they come your way?
I think now with the rollout of the vaccines and things like that, there is a light appearing at the end of the tunnel. So we're lining a few things up all right in terms of gigs and everything else. So, yeah, it's definitely a bit of a clearer picture than it would have been this time last year.
All right. So there's a sense of optimism in what you're saying there.
There is, yeah. Well, I'm a musician, so I'm blindly optimistic anyway most of the time. So that's in full gear at the moment.
And it'll all be part of your next project, which might be a new album, which you will tell me about when the time comes, I'm sure. Listen, great to speak with you both this evening, Bob Gallagher and Ronan Keely.
Thank you very much.
Ronan Keely being Junior Brother. And the Bob Gallagher Presents Junior Brothers Hibernorama. The show will be screened as part of Music Town this Thursday, April the 22nd, and that's at 8 p.m. And for full details of that and all of the events at the festival, go to the website, which is musictown.ie. But that is our lot for this Monday evening here on Arena. We have a great joyous piece for you tomorrow night. Rhiannon Giddens and Francesco Teresi will be in to speak about their highly acclaimed new album, They're Calling Me Home, speaking about some of the tracks on it, tell us about the derivation of it and how they went about making the arrangements. Very interesting stuff indeed. That's tomorrow night on Arena. But for this evening, Leah Murphy and Paula Shields research, Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator, Mark Dwyer was on sound, and tonight's programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. Talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, as usual.